Why is it that it doesn't affect most people this way? If you look at the vast majority of people that have been vaccinated, and that's one of the things that we have to go on in this country, is it literally, what is it? It's over 200 million people, I believe, have been vaccinated. That's an enormous amount of human beings. Most of them are fine. Is that an accurate statement?
You know, it's just, again, just like the respiratory infection. You know, we've had 146 million people who have had the respiratory infection. Less than 1%'s died.
Right, but the ones that have gotten the injection and died or got myocarditis versus the ones who got the injection and nothing happened at all. What's the difference? What happened?
Just like the respiratory infection. Remember, you and I had the respiratory infection. We're perfectly fine. We're sitting here talking. 99% of people who got the respiratory infection are fine. 99% of people who got the vaccine are fine. So we're 200 million people who got the vaccines, and we have about 1 million people injured. So it's the same. They're identically the same. It's the same concept.
So what do you think is causing the damage in the 1%?
Just like with the respiratory infection, it's all about susceptibility. Remember, in the respiratory infection, it's the elderly, those with medical problems, those with comorbidities. It's the same thing. So with the vaccine, it's the elderly. It's with comorbidities. For instance, blood clotting. Those who have inherited proclivity to blood clotting are going to be the ones who are likely to going to form the fatal blood clots that happen with the vaccine. Invariably, there's going to be some determinants of who develops the myocarditis. We have a lead on this, by the way. The myocarditis is not equal in terms of gender. It's running about 80% boys and 20% girls. So it must be some relationship.
Well, I'm
there.
Glad you said boys and not men, because that's what I'm asking you about. Like, these are not people that have a susceptibility to a disease. They don't have a pre-existing condition. They're young people and they're getting myocarditis. So what is causing that?
In a paper from Finland, an important paper done before COVID-19, where they collected all the myocarditis cases in Finland before COVID-19, they established kind of who got it and what was the rate. And in that paper, I believe the first author is Tishopi, what it showed was that there is an age gradient that occurs as one goes from, you know, age 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, very, very little. And then once approaches puberty, it goes up. After age 12, it really goes up, 12 to 17 or 18. And it runs about 80% boys, 90% boys. And importantly, the number per million, you could actually calculate the number per million per year, came out to 4 cases per million per year. So if you figure that we have, let's make it easy math. Let's say we have 70 million kids in the United States, and we do, you know, so 70 times 4, that would be 280 kids with myocarditis. Some people say add on some teenagers or other people, we could get to 700, 800 cases of myocarditis per year. Do you know what we're in affairs right now, Joe? 13,000 certified cases of myocarditis, pericarditis. I know because I've reported some. So some kids have come to my clinic. They've had heart inflammation. We know in a paper by Tracy Hogue from UC Davis, thousands of cases of myocarditis from VAERS and VSAFE, 86% of these kids have to be hospitalized. They're sick. They have chest pain. They have ST segment elevation on the EKG. Sky-high troponins. The blood test for heart injury is about 10 to 100-fold that of a man having a heart attack. These are kids having significant heart damage. About a quarter have incipient heart failure, as seen by echo. I've seen them in follow-up in my clinic. We have to use heart failure drugs. And very importantly, to treat myocarditis, no physical activity. Physical activity can trigger sudden cardiac death. So no physical activity for sure. I've done this in my practice. The point I'm making, Joe, is the CDC calls me and says, Dr. McCullough, we want to review this case with you. And we go over it. And they, you know, we agree after we go over the labs and what have you. 13,000 certified cases of myocarditis, pericarditis. That number should be no more than 600 on a background rate.
So no physical activity. So when these people do have this heart inflammation and then they have physical activity, that's what's causing, like, do you believe, like, there's been a rash of cases of soccer players in particular, I'm sure you're probably aware of this, that have collapsed and or died, and it's much higher than normal. Do you think that that's probably what's attributable to that?
there is a montage of deaths on the soccer field, rugby field, particularly in Europe, overseas. It's interesting, not in the United States, but overseas, that's concerning. Now, of course, you know, each case is its own case. Did they take a vaccine? When did they take a vaccine?
Right.
Could they have subclinical? Could they have taken a vaccine in the last 6 months? Could they have some subclinical symptoms? It's hard when you're a young athlete and you're sore all over. You know, the chest soreness may not be that demonstrable.
Right.
And vigorous physical activity, particularly that start-stop, especially soccer particularly, would make me think. But, you know, if that's the case, and it was myocarditis, wouldn't we be seeing the NBA and NFL and elsewhere? It raises the suspicion. The myocarditis, there's strict warnings against this. Remember, FDA has on Moderna and Pfizer warnings on myocarditis. Jessica Rose and I published in Current Problems of Cardiology a paper from theirs. And the upper tail of the myocarditis for men goes all the way up to age 50. So I'm telling you, I have somebody in my practice who's well above the teenage years who has myocarditis. We're going to see more and more because it's now known, and the FDA agrees, that the vaccines, in fact, do go to the heart. They get distributed all in the body. And in fact, the Koreans, we had the first fatal case of myocarditis I'm aware of, reported from Washington University in St. Louis, an American who took the vaccine. And now the Koreans have reported one patient of a young lady who got put on ECMO. She survived. She got 10 minutes of CPR and got put on extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. She survived. But sadly, another Korean man died and did an autopsy. His heart was loaded with inflammation. You know, the heart swells, gets to be about double the size in a matter of just a few days after taking the vaccine with myocarditis. It's explosive after shot number two.
So two questions in regards to what you just said. One, soccer, I think, is probably one of the most cardio-intensive sports because it's an enormous field and they're constantly running. They have these long sprints. I don't think it's comparable in the same sense as the NBA. I think the NBA is a much smaller playing field, and I just don't think it's – obviously, you have to be in great shape, but I don't think it's as cardio-intensive. The vaccine causing this, if it's – why would it be that are they getting different vaccines in Europe where these soccer players are dropping? And if that's the case, are some vaccines more – do they lead people to be more susceptible to myocarditis? And then the other question is, does myocarditis reverse itself? Like, if you have myocarditis, is that automatically going to take years off your life? Even if you recover from it, because you refer to it as a non-fatal adverse event. If that's a non-fatal adverse event, does one eventually get back to normal with myocarditis?
Yeah, myocarditis, again, if we're at 400 to 800 cases in the United States per year, and over the course of my career, I've seen one or two cases, spontaneous myocarditis, before COVID. And
one or two.
That's it. My whole career, because it's rare, obviously.
And what would that be from? What would be the cause of it?
The most fatal type is called giant cell myocarditis. It literally is idiopathic, comes out of nowhere. We don't know what causes it. There's other forms, adenoviruses, parvoviruses that can cause myocarditis. These are typically treated supportively. There was a randomized trial, and actually Dallas, Texas played a big role in it, called the Myocarditis Treatment Trial, MITT. And that did biopsies and showed routine cardiac biopsies were not useful outside of trying to diagnose giant cell myocarditis. And then lastly, that routine corticosteroids weren't useful. Having said that, when we try to treat patients, we end up using colchicine, sometimes some other drugs. I want to get the right citations down. So the paper from Finland was by Arola and colleagues that came with the estimate of 4 cases per million per year as a baseline. So that means in the United States, 400 to 800 cases a year. We've already gotten to over 13,000 cases in the United States. And we've seen cases of myocarditis, by the way, reported in the U.S. military, been reported from Israel, France, and elsewhere. The paper that showed it directly invades the heart, the spike protein, that was by Avolio and colleagues in the Pericytes. And very importantly, the prognosis is what you're asking about. The prognosis paper was published by Karsten Chopi, And that was in Circulation Research 2019. And what it showed is it showed that 13% of myocarditis, this is before COVID, ends up with progressive heart failure and worsening. My fear is some of these kids who develop myocarditis will be in a 13% category where they have progressive left ventricular dysfunction and heart failure.
So the myocarditis they're experiencing right now is damaged heart tissue, and that damaged heart tissue is not going to heal, and that it, in fact, might get worse.
The estimates are, and again, I'm applying data from other forms of myocarditis before COVID.
Yes.
And COVID looks like a pretty severe form of it, to be honest with you, because it's putting 86% of the kids in the hospital. You know, there's myocarditis that we actually don't hospitalize. We can treat myocarditis and myopericarditis in the office, but these kids are sick enough to be hospitalized. I'm inferring that it's severe forms of it. This estimate from this paper would be 13% risk of, in these kids, of developing heart failure or, you know, needing things like ICDs, heart failure, oral drugs, later on cardiac transplant or cardiac death.
When you say cardiac transplant, you're talking about heart transplant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read, we reviewed a horrible case of a 19-year-old girl who was vaccinated, wound up having a heart attack, heart failure, heart transplant. And then because of the immunocompromising drugs that they put her on to accept the transplant, she got pneumonia and died. 19.
I said on national TV in June, when the FDA just had 200 cases they reviewed, FDA and CDC were 200. The FDA and CDC said two things I think that were irresponsible. I'll call them out on it because I can. And that is they said it's rare and they said it's mild. And I was on national TV saying, listen, in safety research, we never say the word rare. We say tip of the iceberg. This is probably just the beginning of what we're going to see. And it's not mild because even in June, 90% were hospitalized. And sure enough, now we have 13,000 cases, 86% hospitalized. And you know, the Hogan analysis shows that a young boy is more likely to be hospitalized with myocarditis than ever be hospitalized with COVID-19 than respiratory illness.
Yeah, we showed that to Sanjay Gupta, and he was incredulent. When you're looking at this chart in front of you, what percentage of the people recover fully from myocarditis pre-pandemic, pre-COVID-19?
You know, in this paper by Tishopi, this is good. This is like a medical grand rounds on Joe Rogan. I love it, Joe. So in this figure one from the Tishopi paper, 27% never deviated from normal heart function. So they were good all the way through. They were clinically had myocarditis. 26% were categorized as recovered.
Fully.
Fully. 34% improved, but never got back up to completely normal. And then 13% were impaired. I mean, the heart took a hit and they never recovered.
There's a gentleman who is, he holds, what is it, the world's longest static breath hold? Is that what he holds? He's done that 10-minute guy. You know who I'm talking about? That we talked about him on the podcast before. He's he got myocarditis from the vaccine, and it severely limited his ability to do that. He had extreme cardiovascular function, right? Because this is a guy who can hold his breath for 10 minutes. And he says that it's caused somewhere. I mean, it's been, I believe he said it's been 8 months plus since having myocarditis, and still he's somewhere around 30% reduction of his abilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, getting back to your question of, listen, 200 million people took the vaccine. You know, why are so many people fine?
Right.
I think my answer to that, honestly, Joe, is that the body is a miraculous creation, and the body can fight off all kinds of things. So you put some foreign messenger RNA in there, and with synthetic analog caps, Tony Karagopoulos and I have published on this. By the way, the messenger RNA probably stays in the body for a few months. The spike protein, Patterson is showing us, lasts in the body at least 15 months. There's a paper by Banzel and colleagues showing in the vaccinated that you have not only the S1 segment, but you have the S2 segments. You actually get both segments in the vaccinated persisting in the body for a long time, almost certainly beyond 6 months. That if someone took a shot one and shot two in January and February and nothing has happened, I'm following my patients carefully. 70% of people in my practice took the vaccine. Again, good doctors don't encourage, don't discourage. It was purely elective because they're in vaccine research. Fine. No harm, no foul. But if we start vaccinating every 6 months, I think the spike protein never gets out of the body. It accumulates. Progressive accumulation of the spike protein is very worrisome for these progressive organ injury syndromes.
So if we're doing it every 6 months, the spike protein will never really truly have a chance to get out of the body in these cases that you're talking about where it's still in the body for 15 months.
15 months is on the long side. Let's be charitable and say it lasts in the body a year. That's what the Banzel paper and Bruce Patterson in his paper and in his interview on my podcast, America Out Loud Talk Radio, McCullough Report, based on this leading work, I'm telling you as a doctor, I think the spike protein is in the human body after vaccination at least a year. And so if you have a year to clear it out, and you clear it out, and nothing's happened, no harm, no foul. The vast majority of people in my practice did fine with the vaccines. Now, I don't know if they ever came in contact with COVID or not. They did fine. It is my practice experience that when they do get COVID, that it's a milder form. It's easier to treat. Do I still give monoclonal antibodies? Sure. Do they get ivermectin? Yes. And prednisone and all the other drugs, anticoagulants? Sure. Sadly, can vaccinated patients die of COVID-19? Sure. The CDC has told us. The CDC in mid-October had 41,000 full vaccine failure cases recorded by departments of public health. This is just spontaneous reporting. It's not the universe of cases. And about a quarter of those were deaths. So the CDC has large numbers of people who have been fully vaccinated who died. It can happen. But it's our experience, and I shared with you the data, the vaccines do something. They provide a modest protection against hospitalization and death. What we're getting to, Joe, is based on the safety profile we've described and based on the efficacy, is it compelling enough to actually mandate it in people? Or is it something that ought to be a free choice?
And if it is a free choice and you do develop myocarditis, so let's say you have an adverse event when you take the vaccine, what can be done to treat these people?
Treatment of myocarditis would be 3 to 6 months of no physical activity.
Six months no physical activity,
right,
at all?
Right.
No rigorous walks, nothing?
I mean, you know, outside of daily activities, you know, going to class, going home, this and that, but we don't want any, you know, running, weightlifting, soccer,
nothing
gym.
Like, yeah, that.
Because the worry, we trigger cardiac death. And then for when the heart pumping function is reduced, and we see this by echocardiography, MRI, we use what's called evidence-based beta blockers, carvedilol, busoprolol, long-acting metoprolol. And then we use what's called RAS inhibitors, that is ACE inhibitors, angiotensin receptor blockers, or a new drug called Entresto. And that's what I use in myocarditis patients who have impaired pumping function because we're trying to prevent slippage and even worsened heart failure. And then for the pleural pericardial symptoms, we use a drug called colchicine. And colchicine is a drug we actually use in the treatment of COVID-19 acute illness. Remember, the acute illness is similar to the vaccine illnesses. They have so many similar, because it's the same spike protein. We use colchicine in order to try to relieve some of the pericardial symptoms, and our randomized trial suggesting that would help try to extinguish the inflammation in the heart.
Is there anything that someone can take? Let's say if your job mandates that you get vaccinated, is there anything that someone can take that could potentially mitigate the negative effects of the spike protein?
Boy, that's kind of getting into this idea of moral hazard and social contract. So people ask me all the time,
"Yes,
Doc, I'm going to lose my job. My job. I'm losing my job if I don't take the vaccine." And I usually ask them, you know what I ask them? What's a social contract? What do you get? If you take the vaccine, what do you get? Are you getting 20 years of employment, 10, 5, a year?
Are you even getting a guaranteed employment? I mean, they
are you getting
you
6 months?
Week. Yeah.
Are you getting 3 months? They say, I don't know. Nobody told me the social contract. I say, why don't you figure out the social contract before you take a spin with this vaccine? And people are trying to say, listen, can I have my cake and eat it too? Can I take the vaccine and keep my job for some undeclared social contract and take some antidote? Well, there are things that have been suggested on the website. Dr. Tess Lowry from the United Kingdom, who's one of the leaders in early treatment of COVID-19, she's one of the ones who did the great analyses on ivermectin, has started a program. And I think it's called World for Health, something along these lines. You'll find it on the internet. It's got a yellow and pink kind of montage color. And in there are some published approaches on web, not peer-reviewed. Of course, there's no randomized trials of things one could do to reduce the inflammation, the thrombogenicity, and some of the organ injury syndromes. I'm leery of that approach because that's basically creating this moral hazard, meaning that it's okay to take the vaccine and you can just take this antidote to prevent complications. And so this moral hazard, by the way, came up in a radio interview I had with Hugh Hewitt. And I have to tell you, I think it's one of the few difficult interviews I had. And Hugh Hewitt came on, and when he invited me on, Joe, he said, you know, I'm bringing on Dr. McCullough. And I want to say before he gets on, he let us know, he let me know he's an attorney. And he said, I'm pro-vaccine. I think everybody should take the vaccine. And I think this is how we end the pandemic. Whatever. But let me bring on this doctor. And then he asked me a question. He said, Dr. McCullough, he said, if somebody listens to you and they don't get COVID-19, and they don't take the vaccine, and they get COVID-19, and they die, that's on you because they listened to you and they didn't take the vaccine. I said, Hugh, I said, if they listen to you and they take the vaccine, they've been pressured into vaccine research. And if they take the vaccine and they're one of the thousands of people who drop dead within a couple days of the vaccine, I said, that's on you. I said, who's got the bigger moral hazard here? The bottom line is you can dodge COVID forever. There's people who have never gotten COVID. They're dodging COVID fine. In fact, you can not take the vaccine and get treatment for COVID and survive it. I did. I got COVID before the vaccines. For me, it's over with. You got COVID after the vaccines. You got treatment. You got through it. So did Aaron Rodgers. So did so many of us. The bottom line is there's no moral hazard for deferring on the vaccines because the vaccines are research and they're elective. And the vaccines are only to protect the individual. There's no data suggesting the vaccines protect others. This is very, very important. There are now studies. There is a recent study in the journal Lancet that has actually asked the question, do the vaccines actually protect others from getting COVID-19? Because that is really what's going on. There's people in my circles that have said, listen, take the vaccine, protect other people. You don't do it for yourself. You do it for somebody else.
That was a later narrative, though, right?
I know, but we need later research to apply to the later narrative.
Yeah.
Haven't you heard follow the science?
Yeah.
Haven't you even heard that someone claims that they are science?
Yes, I have.
Now, science is a process, and you're laughing. You and I are pretty humble here, but let me tell you, let's follow the science. So this paper is from Annika Singayagamam. And this is published from the ATACCC Study Investigator Group in The Lancet. And this paper just landed in The Lancet. Oh, I can't believe you got it. That's sure terrific. Is. And you know what the storyline here is? 39% of this very careful case contact studies, and it's up on, Joe, it's on my call it here on my slides. 39% of transmission occurred from fully vaccinated to fully vaccinated individuals.
That's a pretty large number.
Yeah. So the point is, we now have abundant evidence. We had the Barnstable County outbreak in Massachusetts that clearly showed, and the CDC told us, Barnstable County, they told us, congregate settings, people got COVID-19, it was Delta. Look at 2/3 are fully vaccinated. We had the naval cruise ship, 3,700 individuals, fully vaccinated. They passed a Delta to each other. Then we had these papers here. We have one from Havers, CDC COVIDNet Network. We have Fillmore from the VA. This is data shading into June. This is before Delta really kicked up. We had 23% of Americans in the hospital who were vaccinated, but they had COVID-19. Remember in June, remember that talking point that was issued? 99% of people in the hospital were unvaccinated?
Yeah.
That's propaganda. That's false information put out by those in position of authority. There was one time, and I was on Laura Ingraham, and they had a montage of everybody saying 99% unvaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
Even the governor of Florida said that. President of the United States said that. That was a false talking point that was issued, and everybody said it. I think designed to encourage people to get vaccinated.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of encouragement to get vaccinated.